When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 178. I'm your host Will Evans, and tonight I am very excited to once again be heading down to Essex to talk to farmer, conservationist, musician, and I'm going to say pusher of boundaries, George Young. George, how are you?
Really good, thanks Will. How are you doing?
Very, very well. You haven't had all this torrential rain we're having up here down there?
No, it's wet enough. we don't really need a huge amount more, but yeah, at least my crops haven't gone flat, which probably means they aren't very good, but you know.
Well, my spring barley's flat, so I was away for the weekend and I came back to that, so the joys of farming. Okay, so I've got an advert to read out for Lee McGrain. Do you want to grow a winter wheat with consistently high yields year after year? Then look up LG Skyscraper from Lee McGrain UK. LG Skyscraper is the highest yielding winter wheat on the HDB RL for 2021 and the last two seasons as well. It's excellent as a first or second wheat on heavy or light soils and for late drilling. It's a soft feed variety with a specific weight of 76.8 and can also provide end market opportunities. LG Skyscraper Winter Wheat, the highest yielding variety on the RL 3 years. I'm going to say that again. LG Skyscraper Winter Wheat, the highest yielding variety on the RL 3 years in a row. George, tell me a bit about your farm. It's in South Essex, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. So a cool little village called Fobbing. I always like to make the joke that everyone's heard of Fobbing, but then they've immediately forgotten about it because it's where the Peasants' Revolt started. So everyone read about it in history when they were, you know, 13 or something.
Do you know that? Yeah, that's right, isn't it? Yes. Yes, I was wondering where I'd heard the name before.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so yeah. That's where Fobbing is. And we have a magnificent church, which was written about in the Doomsday Book. And then we're also then surrounded by, we have the landfill at Pitsea to one side, which is a lovely aesthetic eyesore. We then have the Thames Estuary to one side with, I believe it's the largest port in Europe, the London Gateway port there. And then the A13 on the other side. And there's a particular delight. If you stand on the hill at the back of the farm, you can look out and see the A13. Sometimes you can hear it. Okay. You know, all of the senses, and you'll see the lovely kind of red and blue glow of the Tesco hypermarket. So contextually, that's where we are. We're about 1,200 acres, got kind of two main blocks of land. I'm focusing a lot of my efforts on the 650 acres at home at the moment with the stuff I'm doing. Mm-hmm. But essentially, we're quite a diverse farming operation, trying to become more diverse and essentially undergoing lots and lots of changes. So heritage wheats, niche crops, other kind of more standard arable crops, cattle, a burgeoning fruit production thing that will be going in sort of mm-hmm. 3 or 4 years, mm-hmm. And grain processing as well.
Okay. So farming on the urban fringe, I guess, as it were, brings its advantages and disadvantages, I suppose.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, market-wise for kind of the stuff that I'm doing, the more kind of direct-to-consumer stuff is obviously fantastic. I'm really close to London, sort of a 40-minute train ride to London. Yeah. So, yeah, there's a huge amount of benefit to that. The local community have become a lot better since I've been writing my blogs. So that's three years of blogs.
That's interesting in its own right, though, isn't it? And I think a lot of farmers are finding that over the last few years, haven't they? I've seen a lot of people doing sort of reaching out to local village Facebook groups and things like that. And there really is a value in that, isn't it? You know, you're seeing a really good response, I think.
Exactly. That mixing that with Open Farm Sunday, so like people actually coming out to the farm and seeing what I'm doing and actually getting that support and people understanding why. There was a really fun one recently, last winter. I'd kind of explained I was planting all of the trees and it's in a field opposite a load of houses. Mm-hmm. And then as I planted them on our local WhatsApp group, there was this moment of realization from a few people who lived opposite this field. So they're like, oh, we're going to lose our view. and I looked at this and I thought, I'm not going to say anything about this at the moment. I'm just going to let this play out. And there's a really nice little discussion on the WhatsApp group, which ended with people deciding that actually it was going to be a more interesting view. A, it wasn't going to get... You know, they were still going to have a view for sort of 10 to 15 years.
Yeah.
And then that view would vary between a leafy view in the, you know, spring and the summer, and then the colors in the autumn, and then they would lose their leaves and they get the view of the farm. So actually, I think they think it's a cool thing now.
Mm.
But that was a really fun little experiment to see, changing the face of the farm.
So have your family farmed there long?
So we have been on... this farm since 1954,
okay,
which is quite a long time now.
Yeah.
And we've been in this locality, so Corringham, which is literally the town next to this, so half a mile away. We were farming there since 1935.
Okay.
That was one of those funny times when you could work hard for 19 years and buy 210 acres and I think four houses. And wait, do you think you could work hard for 19 years now and do that?
No.
but essentially, like pretty much every farmer in the southeast, we are descended from Scots blood. Fenwick, just south of Glasgow. I actually even 18 months ago went up and found the old family farm and took some pictures and stuff. I was so excited. It was a 2-hour detour to go to this farm, and it's not farmed anymore. The yard and house has been sold off, and it's owned by someone who owns a trucking company.
Okay.
Who didn't care at all that my heritage was from there. It's like, well, what are you doing here? It's like, well, apparently nothing. So I'll leave. Just a 2-hour detour. It's fine. Not a problem.
But I think it's really interesting, actually, that. That sort of mass Scottish migration to Essex. It wasn't something I knew much about, but I've interviewed a few people from the podcast who farmed down there who've had roots in Scotland. It's something I need to look into more.
Like we thought that they like lost the tenancy or something, but I did a load of research a few years ago, and we worked out that there would essentially have been at least two sons, and there wasn't room on the tenancy for the second son. So he got a few cows, and they put all the cows on a train.
Yeah.
As you do. Go, go on, pootle down to Essex in 1895, and that was that.
Brilliant. So with all those deep connections and farming roots, surely you grew up desperate to be a farmer, right?
I was the very antithesis of anyone wanting to farm whatsoever. growing up, I had zero practical skills whatsoever. Thankfully, there's a lovely platform on the internet called YouTube where you can learn all of these things. I'm somewhat more practical now. But I used to like being on the farm.
Yeah.
I used to like walking the dog and falling in ditches and stupid things like that when I got told off by mum and dad. But I had, just no inclination to farm whatsoever. And the times, so dad never pushed me into farming, which I think is brilliant. There's nothing better than kind of not having that kind of someone, that expectation to farm. So I had no interest. And I was 14 or 15 when I first drove a tractor myself. I used to like sitting in the dicky seat with dad, everyone does, you know.
Yeah.
I specifically remember one harvest when I was probably about 7 or 8, asking about the birds and the bees with dad and him being really awkward about it. I know exactly where I was on the farm and everything. And the tractor. Anyway,
as dads usually are in those situations. Yeah.
The first time I remember him putting me on a tractor, the old 10.56, which we don't have anymore, which I think is a shame. On a set of rolls, same set of Twos rolls that we have now. They're not doing very well anymore. But anyway, And I can remember sitting on this tractor and him getting me going. And he said, when you feel comfortable, go up a gear.
Yeah.
Now, this is my dad's version of teaching. His version of teaching me how to reverse a trailer was get in a tractor and trailer and reverse it without any guidance. Yeah. So anyway, I heard on the rolls, when you're comfortable, go up a gear. So surely doing a job quicker means you're, you know, doing it more efficiently.
Of course it does. Yeah, of course it exactly. does.
Especially when you haven't been told the purpose of rolling, other than to cover the field with this metal roll. So went up a gear and quite quickly get quite used to that, don't you? So found another gear and another gear. And it was quite a warm day. So I'm guessing it was October. I don't think it was spring. So I opened the back window as well. It was a dusty October, and we haven't had one of those for a long time.
No.
And it was a Sunday. And so we had Sunday lunch, obviously, at 1 o'clock. I remember coming back to the yard with the rolls, and I came down to lunch, and Dad said, how are you getting on? I said, oh, well, I finished. And just this look of complete and utter disbelief. And I was there. I was completely black from the dust. So I don't think Mum was very happy either, just putting dust everywhere. And yeah, it transpired like, you know, Dad would expect me just to go up one gear, presumably to sort of 8 or 9K, mm-hmm. rather than the probably 20 kilometers an hour that I actually rolled the field at. But the worst thing is my sister, who has zero inclination whatsoever for any of these things, she then had to go and do the rolling. We used to employ two people then, so I don't know why Dad was getting his children involved. But anyway, so yeah, that was a really auspicious start to farming. And my other one involved rowing up linseed straw when I was 21. I guess maybe I was at a loose end on a weekend and Dad just needed a hand at harvest. So out on the Sanderson with those horrible tines on the front that always get stuck in the ground if you mess up. So you end up with a really bent machine, don't you? Anyway, so yeah, going up, rowing up the linseed straw. And again, Dad's guidance was just to put them into piles and then set them on fire, which is obviously every arsonist's dream. Yeah. Out of fires. And it's great when you set that on fire and then the hedge also starts setting on fire and then it goes up the hedge. So the most auspicious beginning to a farming career, and someone who cares massively about nature as the hedge destructor that I was.
So you weren't going to be a farmer. So what direction did you decide to go in instead?
So when I was sort of 16, 17, all I wanted to be was a musician. So I started playing the clarinet when I was 7. Started playing the sax when I was 11. I'd always wanted to play the sax.
Is it musical family? Are you from?
So my sister was very musical as well.
Okay.
Who's 3 years older than me. So she played the trombone, and actually my oldest brother used to do the sound. So he was 8 years old.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
So I used to go to, you know, school concerts when I was sort of 3, and I just remember seeing the saxophone, and it was specifically the tenor sax, not the alto sax. The tenor sax. It was all like the curvy neck.
Yeah.
I remember seeing that and just thinking that is it. That's it. That is cool. As someone who's never been cool his entire life, the fact that age 3, I thought I could be cool by playing an instrument is somewhat ironic, but never mind. I knew I had to play the sax, and as a pretty small 7-year-old, there was no way of playing the sax then. So clarinet was kind of the natural option. And when I was small, in the house that I'm actually living in now, I can remember having a massive paddy. I was probably 8 or 9, as I'm sure every kid learning music has. I didn't want to play the clarinet anymore. And I think Dad was like, oh, fine, I can't deal with this, you know. And Mum was like, no, you must carry on playing the clarinet. So I carried on playing. And I'm so glad, because I think it was about when I was 15, 16 that I learned the very best thing about music in my family was the fact that I could get away with not revising by practicing music instead.
I'd
just like play my sax all day, and then Mum would come in and be like, do you think you should do some revision? You know. I was probably reasonably sensibly, my parents weren't very happy with me going off to do a music degree. I mean, ironically, as a farmer, that wouldn't make any difference, right?
No.
Whatever degree.
No.
And I was persuaded to do mathematics.
Okay. Right. So a bit of a change, yeah. So you went to uni to study maths?
I went to Edinburgh University. the funny thing, so I did really enjoy maths at school, and I did double maths for A level, and quite frankly, found it pretty easy.
Yeah, okay.
And there really needs to be a change in how maths is taught, because maths at school versus maths at university, they are two distinct subjects that have very, very little in common. And there's nothing worse than what were you like at maths at school? Were you?
Absolutely hopeless. I'm virtually number dyslexic, but my eldest daughter is really good at it. She's amazingly to me. She's she's probably better than I am, but very good.
Do you remember the moment you hit the wall with maths?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I remember going from the age of like 13, 14, 15 and seeing friends of mine hit the wall and thinking, what's going on with them? And then for me, age 21, like far too late to be able to change my course, hitting that wall and being, that's what everyone else had the problem with. And when you hit that wall in maths, there's nothing you can do. It's just impossible. So, I really stopped enjoying lectures at that point.
did you? It just became went from being something you enjoyed to something that was just a chore.
Yeah. So I at that point massively threw myself into music at university. Begun doing a lot of work in film as well. So that was just kind of, I'd always loved going to the movies. And at that point in time, I was like, well, I'm going to try and start making movies because why not, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So you got through your maths degree, though, at uni. What direction did you go in then?
So, I got a spectacular 2-2 degree. It was almost a third. I almost feel like I could be more proud of a third. No one gets a 2-2, do they? They get a first, they get a 2-1, or they proudly receive a third. If you get a 2-2, you know you failed with a 2-2. Essentially, when I'd been at university every summer, again, being close to London, every summer I worked, did temp work for banks.
Mm-hmm.
So, finished university and it was a logical thing to get a job. Mum and dad obviously wanted me to get a job. So I went and worked originally for Deutsche Bank, which was pretty fun. And this was 2008.
Okay.
Which for a lot of people might not necessarily mean, I mean, I guess it probably does mean quite a lot for a lot of people. As a very naive, 22-year-old at the time, I started work in July. And in September, everything got exciting.
I bet it did.
Yeah, Lehman Brothers, who we did a lot of work with, went under. And then there was a really exciting weekend. And on the Friday evening, everyone wondered if Morgan Stanley were going to go under.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until Monday morning whether we knew whether or not that was actually going to happen. Just a completely bamboozling time for me. Of not understanding what was happening, but it being really, really exciting. I was in a bank that was, well, a German bank. They were quite solid, but just a strange, very strange time to be starting a career in something.
But did you ever want to be a professional musician? Did you sort of after uni? Did you think about going in that direction instead? Or
so I did briefly. There was actually even a time before I came back to the farm, when I actually almost decided to do a year as a professional musician then. It would have been super tough to have done it at 22 my realization now. And I've got a lot of friends who are professional musicians now, so I know kind of how difficult it is. Mm-hmm. But gaining contacts in London is an absolute nightmare. And it's always one of those funny things. Like, so when I was a kid, I was, one of the best musicians at school. Then you go to university, end up being one of the best musicians at university.
Yeah.
Then you go to London and you're really crap.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are all these amazing musicians. So that was kind of quite a sharp wake-up call to me then, that I wasn't able to play at the level that I wanted to play at. And actually that really big wake-up call that I wasn't as good as I wanted to be. With the financial crash, a lot of things changed in banking. And the job that I was doing moved to Birmingham, which I didn't want to move to. I was all right living in the east.
In the southeast.
It was at that point that, having kind of really enjoyed film all that time, I was like, well, you know what? I don't think music's right for me at this time. I was enjoying playing kind of casually music and playing with friends, but I didn't think that was a sensible career choice. So I thought I'd throw myself into film. So I went and did a film editing course at Ealing Studios. And then there are these websites, I'm assuming they still exist, I can't remember what they're called, but websites you can basically put yourself out there.
Yeah. Okay.
And there are all these amateur filmmakers. So I was touting myself as an editor. And if anyone's interested in seeing how poor I am at editing, I have a second YouTube channel, which is actually my first YouTube channel, which is just George L. Young. And on there is kind of my attempt at being a film editor, with definitely with poor material that I was given, but I did not make these not very good movies any better by trying to edit them. So, yeah, which, I mean, I'm really glad I did all of that. And it's proven, I mean, everything in life is pretty circular, right? So the fact that I now edit videos has...
Yeah, I was going to say, you can tell, you know, because your videos, and a lot of people listening will have seen your the videos you do, and you can see that you've got a background in that, you know. Yeah. I know you're
not necessarily very good, but I think about it.
Yeah, no, but it must have been, I don't know, I guess something like that's a hell of a life experience doing something like that, though, isn't it? You must have met some, you know, really interesting people and had some brilliant times.
Well, so they're the times that are brilliant after the fact rather than when you're experiencing. There are lots of things in life like that, aren't there?
Yeah.
And so obviously if you're trying to get into the film industry, so I was 24 at this stage, and most people choose to go running when you're just literally gophering for the production team.
Yeah.
Most people choose to go running when they're 16, 17, 18.
Okay.
And you can deal with it at that age, because if people give you shit, you're like, well, oh, it's fine. Yeah. Like, it's...
You're just happy to be there.
Exactly. When you're 24 and you've come from a job when you were kind of reasonably well respected and people treated you nicely, it's not quite the same. But my favorite thing, so obviously you get work experience at various places, and it was a production house called Molinaire that I presume is still there in Soho. You always have to go running in Soho, all these different production houses, and you have to know where everyone is and running around with reels of film and stuff like this. But one of the main jobs you had was being a T-boy.
Okay.
Which is just as glamorous as you think. So you'd be waiting around in the kitchen, eating a lot of toast and Marmite, waiting for a call to come from one of the editing suites, normally for people wanting toast and jam and Marmite and tea and coffee.
Yeah.
And my favorite thing, so I was there for a week doing this, getting in really early in the morning, et cetera, et cetera. Getting paid nothing because, again, that's how the film industry works. And so I got a call down from whatever studio it was, wanting the normal plate of stuff for breakfast. Yeah. So I loaded this tray up, and I'm really poor. I wouldn't be a very good waiter. I'd spill everything. So I was really gingerly when you walk up the stairs, et cetera, et cetera. And then obviously to open these doors, you have to fart around with the handle, don't you? And you go in backwards. So I walked in backwards with this tray. And as I turned around, and there's the producer, a couple of producers sitting on the sofa. There's, you know, the director and the editor at the desk, and there's a big projector screen showing it and the little computer screens. And I go in with this tray, mid the most explicit sex scene I've ever seen, and it's 8 o'clock in the morning. These people are just chilling out. They just want a cup of tea, cup of coffee, bit of Marmite, and a load of sex. So it was the strangest experience of my life. Probably the only good story I've got from working in film. life experiences. There you go. That's what it taught me.
I don't know quite what to say to that, really. I suppose for people who work in the job, I guess they're used to that kind of thing. But
they've probably been interrogating that scene for the last God knows how long, and we're pretty bored of it. But to a 24-year-old, it was very exciting. So
you decided, though, that that wasn't for you, ultimately, film. So where did you go from there?
So essentially my money was running out, having done, it was like 9 or 12 months, I think I did, trying to do that. So my money was running out, and I thought, well, let's go back into a career that I kind of know.
Yeah.
So I ended up going back into banking, and this was actually in commodities, and specifically ended up working in oil. Which, again, slightly ironic as the sort of concept.
Isn't it?
Never mind, you know, everyone's a bit of a hypocrite, right? Ended up going back into that. And that was partly to fund the fact that I was still trying to make films in my spare time, mm-hmm. Or edit films in my spare time. Again, not very well. And also I was doing a lot of music then with friends, playing in a couple of big bands. I'd started a funk band. I started a trad jazz band as well, which is one of my favorite types of music. So I was kind of doing all that and working in banking, and actually ended up, it was a really cool job. I ended up in the front office, actually, essentially it was on a physical team, so trading physical crude oil. And my job was to ensure that the financial position that we held in crude oil hedged that long physical position. So I had to trade the short position.
Sure, okay.
Which was a deal worth, I think it was $700 million.
Okay, just like farming, isn't it?
That I had to not mess up each day. I remember that being quite exciting. But working until sort of, it was a good day if I finished at 7.
Okay.
Normally I was finishing at 9, 10, sometimes 11.
Yeah.
It's not really very fun then. Mm. And essentially it just reached a stage where I wasn't, that job was then, because I always I always want to do any job to the best of my ability. So then that job was getting in the way of me doing a lot of music, so precluding me from doing gigs. And I just thought, something's got to change here.
Yeah.
Dad would have been, how old would he have been then? I guess he would have been sort of 60, 61 at the time.
Okay.
And I think I was probably complaining about how busy I was. And he just kind of mentioned, we said, why don't you come home to farm? He said, it's a good life. He didn't mention that it made no money.
I mean, no, they never do that, do they?
No, that could be the key point. Because having had a salary, it's strange not having one. So I just, banking was in a dreadful place at the time. No one was able to move between jobs. So they were being really harsh on not paying people pay rises or anything like that. And joyously, I was able to go into an office one day and say, oh, by the way, I'm resigning. And said I was going farming, which shocked everyone. They all knew I came from a farm.
Yeah.
No one believed I'd go farming. I think the same amount of shock as was felt by the farming community around South Essex, where George is coming farming. But I never thought I'd like it. I genuinely didn't think I'd like it. I thought I'd like the lifestyle. Amusingly, I thought I'd like shooting. So I even bought my dog Winston, who is the benchmark of how long I've been back on the farm, is from a gun dog breeding line. I thought, I'm going to like shooting. I'm going to buy a shotgun. And I came back and I tried it once and thought, I do not like that. <That's> I do not want to go shooting.
Yeah. So how old were you then? What?
27 when I came home.
27. Yeah. Okay. So it must have been, I don't know, I guess for your parents, if you were never going to come home to farm, to suddenly, it must have been, I don't know, it must have been really nice for him, I guess.
Yeah, except I was rubbish on everything. And I was 27 and had had quite a lot of kind of responsibility at the bank. So then I was massively argumentative with Dad about the way he was doing things, I don't think he'd ever had. It never had someone be like
no,
that.
No.
So I'm sure I wasn't easy to work with for a while.
What did the farm look like then? What was the system then at that time?
Back then we were very, very conventional. Okay. Or I guess we should probably say conventional for the time. So three crops, wheat, rape and peas. We did have livestock in the form of cattle, but they were just store cattle. So this was Dad's hobby. He used to go to Ashford Market, buy them at sort of 6, 7, 8 months old, something like that, and then grow them on. And sometimes we get some fat cattle. Sometimes they'd just be kind of grown store cattle. And they get sold at, 24, 25 months, something like that. But they were never part of the arable farming.
Okay.
Thing. They were on our rough marshes or in a shed,
Yeah. Okay.
And we were mostly a min-till system, some ploughing, but essentially it was once or twice over with a press, and then seeding into that with a more uni drill or a something else. I'm great with machinery. I know my machinery. Some other type of drill that we had to put something else in the ground. Just a very, very conventional farm, which is, I think, possibly one of the reasons why I didn't think I'd like farming, and actually wouldn't like farming if that's the way I was farming.
Yeah. So what was your... I find this really interesting that you came back at that age and without sort of having been involved in the farm before. What was your... Because I find that interesting, because I would have thought that would mean you'd come home and just kind of settle into that system and carry on, which is, you know, let's face it, that's what a lot of people do. So what was your eureka moment where you realized that, I don't know, that you found your passion?
So I'm one of the few people who still has an independent, doesn't have an independent agronomist. Right? Everyone seems to massively complain at people who have, you know, paid for agronomists. But my agronomist is with ProCam, a guy called Kevin Piercy, who happens to be one of the good guys. There are good guys who work for these big firms as well, as, you know, they're not all monsters.
No.
And as it happens, so we've had Kevin for, I think, like 13 years now. And he is the same agronomist as Simon Cowell uses.
Okay.
Simon Cowell, obviously a very well respected farmer, very well known. And he's only sort of 45 minutes away from me. So knowing that I needed to know about growing crops, et cetera, I ensured that I religiously went out with Kevin on, you know, every time he came, every fortnight, mm-hmm. I'd walk the crops with him and learn, et cetera, et cetera. And he said, well, look, why don't you come and meet Simon? I'm sure he'd like to meet you. Mm-hmm. I was probably being a pain in the ass and asking lots of questions of Kevin. So I thought maybe, you know, offer that to someone else. And went and met Simon and saw his no-till system. And I've been asked this a few times lately, and I can't quite remember what it was at Simon's, like what specific thing it was at Simon's that really lit up in me. At the moment, there's just like a feeling of going on that farm. I think there was a lot more life. I remember his soil just felt lovely under my feet, like really springy. That was the one thing that really kind of locked itself in. As well as that, Simon is just such a lovely guy and so generous, and generous with his ideas, and, you know, really great to chat to. So I feel very fortunate to have him as, you know, a reasonably close neighbor now. It got me thinking that, like, this has to be the way forward. Essentially, I came back from that and said to Dad, we're going to go no-till. And Dad was like, well, I don't think we are. We were lucky because we had this Moore uni drill, which is a pretty decent no-till drill anyway on the farm, which we used, you know, behind the press or whatever. Yeah. So we kind of had a tool that would work, which was really handy. So I spent about 6 months just putting articles in front of Dad. One's about, like, oh, if you're subsoil, then you're sinking as far as your subsoiler depth and all this nonsense.
That's what I have to do with my dad. You have to plant the seed and then
precisely. And then eventually you get there.
Yeah.
Sort of a year after I came home, we went 100% no-till on the farm. And it became pretty apparent that there were limitations with that kind of seeder. So I used to kind of block up in pea stubble and stuff like that. So we were kind of looking around for other drills at the time. Heard about cross lot drill, went and saw Tom Sewell down in Kent, who had made one. And we saw that drill working. And within the system of agriculture that we were doing at the time, farming 1,200 acres, it was a complete no-brainer. We needed that drill, and it's a phenomenal drill, and I wouldn't at all backtrack on the sort of the journey that I've been on by using that tool to get to where I am in farming today.
So what kind of improvements have you seen to the soil in that time from when you were quite sort of conventional min-till to now? What kind of improvements have you seen?
So there is some which I think depends on soil type. So we've expected to see our drains run clear, and that's not been the case. We're on very heavy clay, and I think it's a sign that your soils are really not in a very good state and that you need to do something else. Zero till is not the thing that will fix your soils. Mm-hmm. It is part of the armory of tools that you can use. But there's a hell of a lot more you've got to do to fix that. So we were expecting the drains to be running clear, but I mean, we're whatever it is now, 7 years no-till, and we're still getting muddy drains. So that's not the case in our soil. We have definitely got springier soils, which is nice. Yeah. The thing that I've liked best is the habitat creation, or it's not really habitat creation. It's just not habitat deletion because you're not disturbing. It's the fact that, you know, we'll be seeding stuff and you'll see mice and voles and stuff kind of running around the openers of the drill, and you'll see their holes are still intact and don't get destroyed. So that side, that for me has been the best response, like how are you able to bring and enhance and keep nature in the middle of your fields, was that, you know, which is kind of pretty central to what I'm trying to do now. But that I think that was the biggest improvement I saw.
Yeah. Okay. So that was, I guess the first big decision you made. When did you, let's go on to talk about this now, but when did you sort of go from having the mindset of producing commodities to wanting to produce food? When did that change happen?
So essentially, I love learning. I'm not very good at reading. Reading is not a good medium for me. I'm one of those osmosis readers. I have lots of books and I kind of hope, therefore, that I somehow absorb the knowledge. I learn best from either visiting people's farms or listening to talks or that kind of thing. So the first sort of year and a half of no-till, I was going to tons and tons of talks on going to people's farms and learning loads. And it was really exciting for me and Dad, because we were completely changing the system of farming. So Dad was learning with me. So it was a really, a great bonding experience for us. So that was a really exciting time. And then I just remember kind of being excited to go to these meetings and just not learning anything. And it just, my learning just stopped. Mm-hmm. And I knew there was nothing new to learning this. And at the time I just thought, well, I haven't learned it all. I knew I hadn't learned it all, but I wasn't able to learn anything else. And it was 2017, about this time of year, because it was NOC, which is the National Organic Combinable Crops Open Day. First organic event I went to, which is actually tomorrow or probably yesterday when this podcast comes out. Which is at John Pawsey's this year. And I went to that in 2017, and it was like just the doors to an entire new world being completely blown off. And so this was when I first met Kimberly Bell, who runs Small Food Bakery in Nottingham. And so she was talking about working with the YQ population wheat that was developed by Martin Wolf of Wakelands Agroforestry. Mm-hmm. That had been grown on by Mark Lee in Shropshire. So Kim was working with Mark's wheat, making this bread, and having been a
former rock and roll farming guest, right, Mark Lee.
Exactly. Having lived in London, I obviously liked sourdough and got into that thing. So
yeah, of course you did.
Yeah, I was one of those guys.
I didn't realize I was interviewing a hipster.
I could have called myself something else, but you know. eating this sourdough suddenly, this sound like to me now, this sounds so stupid, but like actually genuinely eating something and thinking about, hang on, that was genuinely wheat in a field.
Yeah.
And learning about that link between what we're growing and actual food. And I mean, what I love is the fact that, you know, I've been on this journey for 4 years now, learning about food. And I'm consistently learning more and more and more and more. And I just love it. I both love it and hate it. It's one of those things where you think, the time when I knew none of this and was really ignorant was fantastic. And I used to go and buy, I'd go and happily buy meat in the supermarket without thinking twice.
Yeah.
I wouldn't read the labels on things and think, oh, that's, why on earth am I buying this from wherever in the world this is coming from? It just exploded my mind. And actually it was kind of a combination between that event. So that was when I started work. Well, I knew I had to get some YQ seed at the time. So yeah. I got some YQ seed from the Organic Research Center. Then that began my conversation with Hodmedod. So Josiah Meldrum and William Hudson in particular, but Nick Saltmarsh as well. So that was, there's actually a funny little story here that I remember going up and meeting them for the first time when I was interested in growing for them. And I'd had a chat on the phone with Josiah, which is never actually a chat with them, because I rang up And I'd wanted to grow buckwheat for years because I thought it was really pretty.
Yeah.
Is how a lot of my decisions make. Oh, it's pretty. Oh, I'll say that. So I wanted to grow buckwheat for years. And so I rang Jasara up and I said, oh, hi, I'm George. I'd like to grow some buckwheat for you. And he said, yeah, no, we don't need anyone to grow any buckwheat. So, okay. So then we got chatting and I talked about my farming system and what I was doing and very much naively from where I am now. And after about a 10-minute chat, he then said, so do you want to grow some buckwheat for us?
That's nice, isn't it?
And then I went up and had a pub lunch with William and Josiah up near their HQ. And it's funny because they remember that lunch really well as well. And the way they tell it is the fact that they didn't particularly like where I was at the time and what I was doing.
Mm.
They thought I was asking the right questions.
Yeah, okay.
So at the time, I was vehemently kind of like, no, I'm not going to go organic. I don't need to go organic. So it's funny how things change.
Definitely. Yeah, I'm just writing down asking the right questions because I think that's the title for this show. After speaking to them, and I suppose you can just tell from the, you know, the enthusiasm in your voice that you'd found your calling, I suppose. So, I mean, you've made it. It's not just that you've started growing pulses and buckwheat and different things. I mean, you've kind of transformed the farm, or in the process of transforming the farm. So, I mean, we could probably talk all day about some of the things you're doing, but I mean, let's hear a brief overview of what you are doing now and where you've come over, where you've.
I mean,
progressed over the last few years.
Yeah, the funniest thing is how essentially it's all happened in the last sort of 6 months, but it's been in the works for sort of 4 or 5 years. Some of this I blame Anna Jones of Just Farmers.
Another former guest of the show.
Yeah, doing the first Just Farmers with her, and then meeting, you know, Stephen Briggs and Stephen Ware and, you know, Rob Thornhill, like all these people, and learning about their farming system and thinking, oh, I really want that on the farm.
Yeah.
So like that was the planting of a lot of seeds back when I did that course, whenever that was. So essentially the things that I'm doing now. So back last December, we put in 50 acres of agroforestry, which is based on, 36 meter alleys for growing the crops, mm-hmm. and 6 meter belts for growing the trees. And I've actually specifically put in at least 2 rows of trees in those belts, depending on the type of tree.
What kind of tree have you got? Is it all the specific types? Is it all fruit, or is it
all the trees?
All the trees.
So I've got some belts which are kind of for timber production. So they've got, you know, all the kind of normal UK woodland trees. We've got some birch in there, which, provided we don't get too warm, we should be able to tap for their sap, a bit like maple syrup, maple tree for their sap. But that's sort of a 15-year time frame on that.
What's the sap used for? This is something I should know, but I don't. What's it used for?
This is a problem I have. So this was Kimberly Bell, who I mentioned earlier, just texting me at sort of 11 o'clock one evening saying, have you heard about birch sap? So I'd spent an hour investigating it, then not sleeping very well because I was thinking about it, and then thought, okay, I had to have birch in my system. So you can do exactly the same. So you can make birch syrup exactly as you can make maple syrup.
Wow.
But it's something along the lines of that maple syrup is a 10-to-1 reduction from the sap. Birch syrup is 100-to-1 reduction.
Right. Okay.
So it needs to be 10 times more expensive than maple syrup. And maple syrup is already expensive, right?
Yeah, it is.
So I mean, if it works, I would probably like to do something along the lines of a birch sap wine or birch sap champagne, something along those lines, when you don't then have to reduce it. But I think there's something really interesting, intriguing in trying to do alternative forms of sugar production, because ultimately our sugar production isn't necessarily particularly sustainable.
How else
can we get sugar out of things that we do in the UK? I've got some belts of willow, essentially because I learned, again, quite last minute, just how amazing willow is for Working as like a ray meal compost, so when you cut it when it's small, really high nitrogen content, etc. They've not done very well, but we'll ignore that. Lots of things fail. I've just got to plant a lot more trees again this winter. But then essentially we've got so many types of fruit. It's a little bit bananas, but we've got a load of fruit bushes, so berries and currants. Gooseberries are tons of gooseberries about at the moment, and it feels such a treat to kind of pick about at gooseberries, and obviously the black currants and red currants and stuff. Just have a little nibble. But yeah, then we've got obviously apples, pears, peaches, nectarines, apricots, quinces, plums, damsons, mirabelles, medlars. I'm missing a load of stuff. We've got a load of nuts as well. Some of which have got to go in this year because they didn't have the trees last year. So kind of pretty much everything you could think of. And this is, I've done this partly because I'm most interested in the effect the trees have on me being able to grow crops in the middle of the field. Mm-hmm. So I am really intrigued by the trees themselves, and I love the nutritional diversity I can then have on my farm. Like I'm able to produce all this different nutrition rather than just kind of wheat and rape or whatever. But as well as that, it's kind of there. I'm not going to plant any agroforestry again for probably 4 or 5 years, because it's going to then show me, well, what does do well on my farm? And you know, what am I then going to plant up in other bits? I'm quite hopeful. We're in a weird little microclimate here, partly because of the river being so close. So we're more of sort of a northwest France sort of microclimate.
Okay.
So I'm pretty confident in sort of the peaches and the nectarines and those more interesting fruits, which is why I'm also trying almonds and pomegranates and persimmon this year as well.
So where do you plan to sell the fruit? What's the route to market?
So essentially this all folds into that being in the locale of London. And through kind of the relationships I'm building with bakers through obviously developing a flower market, which is really going to kick off after this harvest. My hope is essentially through that, and with restaurants I'm beginning to work with, that I will essentially be able to say, by the way, I've got this many kilos of this fruit coming up in a week's time. And there are so many restaurants now springing up that are sort of nose to tail seasonal. So they, you know, the idea of them being able to work with someone who's 20 miles away, and they'll just create some dishes around what you happen to have at that time. I mean, it's very much a build it and they will come model, certainly. Like, I haven't worked out how to harvest this fruit yet. People always ask me that, and I think, why would I worry about that? Like, that's a problem for me in sort of 3 or 4 years' time. That's not a problem for me now.
You've got enough going on at the moment.
Exactly.
Oh, that's tremendously exciting, though. I mean, you mentioned the flour there as well. Let's just talk about that. You've bought a flour mill.
It's a new American stone mill. So it comes, it's a Vermont granite from America, which being like, so often you get these composite stones that come from Europe that don't need sharpening very often at all. So every few years, this one needs sharpening quite often, but in theory makes the very best wholemeal flour. So I thought that was a sort of compromise worth making. So it didn't really feel like a choice as to whether or not to buy the flour mill. It was much more of a necessity, because so I've started growing heritage wheats sort of after the first year I grew the YQ, then I sort of began growing these heritage wheats as well. And just because of where I am in the UK, we're in the wheat belt, which means the mills are gigantic. So the minimum quantity you might be able to get milled by someone else is 9 ton, and that just doesn't work. Got to work in much, much smaller quantities. So it was kind of just one of those things that I knew I had to bite the bullet and buy a mill and learn how to mill my own flour to be able to develop that business further. And the heritage wheats fit so well into the system of farming that I'm doing, because they're tall and they're pretty disease tolerant, and they look really beautiful. I'm trying to get a hashtag going on Instagram, which is farming with beauty. Cause I don't think people, I don't think they care enough about how beautiful things look. And I'm very specific that beauty isn't things being tidy and mown and square and neat or anything like that. Like scruffiness is beauty, and you know, having loads of different animals is beauty, and just having loads of flowering plants is it's just trying to really get that mix and diversity and that kind of a farm with a lot of soul to it, essentially. Somewhere that when you walk around it, you really feel sort of hunkered down into it, and like it's a really safe place rather than just some factory production system, you know.
Yeah, I really like that, farm with a lot of soul. That in fact, that's a better title for the show. I'm going to go with that one. So I suppose I guess it was quite a logical decision for you to decide to go to organic conversion then. I guess it was quite a straightforward decision.
It was a really long time coming. I've had a lot of grief for this. Essentially for a long time when I was farming as a no-till farmer who was 100% passionately behind zero-till as the absolute way forward. For me, I kind of thought, well, yeah, it's that ultimate question. What is worse? Is it worse to plow your soils or cultivate them to some extent? Or is it worse to use glyphosate?
Yep.
And my view was that I wanted to be organic, save for using glyphosate. So I wouldn't use any other inputs, but I would use glyphosate. And a lot of it was actually driven by market originally. So it was people I was talking to, and they're like, well, we can't. Some people would kind of cheekily stock my flour, but then and not tell people it wasn't actually officially organic. But it was kind of one of those awkward things that there were certain people I couldn't sell to because I wasn't organically certified. So I kind of thought, well, I'm so close to being organic anyway. Maybe I should do it. And a couple of years ago, I went out to Sweden with Hodmadods and a bunch of other farmers from the UK to go and visit sort of the Swedish version of Hodmadod, which is a company called Nordisk Gravara. We went all around Sweden, and there was a farm we visited there that were running a type of rotavator, a really kind of controllable type of rotavator that did a really great job at essentially spitting out the roots of the plants behind to kill the plants that way.
Yeah.
And that was the moment for me when I suddenly thought, hang on, like this isn't me choosing to go organic because the market is demanding it. That tool makes sense to me in my system. I haven't tried it yet. It might be an absolute disaster, but that's the kind of sort of style of organic farming that I'm looking to go down. So not necessarily plow based. I'm sure there'll be a plow in the system somewhere. But essentially, it really hammered home to me this year because so the agroforestry field is sort of three fields over from the farmyard, and two fields over from the farmyard is a crop of spring wheat, conventionally grown. But with zero tillage. And what most farmers would consider is like the way to farm at the moment. So it had a really decent cover crop in front of it and then was zero tilled into that cover crop with spring wheat. And we even burned it off. So we burned off that cover crop after we sowed the wheat into it. So like the absolute like perfect version of zero till farming. And I was walking across this field, and obviously you get that time when the wheat's just beginning to poke out and the crop's dying off nice, you know, the cover crop's dying off nicely.
Yeah.
So to most farmers, they'd look at that and think, wow, what an absolute cracking job. Like we've really nailed it. But there are a couple of things for me. For a start, it's the realization that I need to, well, we by doing no-till for the time we've done it, we're now beginning to get to a stage that glyphosate isn't enough.
Mm-hmm.
And we're beginning to get a slight tweak in our weed burden towards plants that don't get killed very well by glyphosate. So we have to put something like shark in the tank as well, which like, so all of a sudden you're taking quite a cheap pass of about £7 a hectare to sort of £17 a hectare. So that's a lot more money all of a sudden. And also I was just looking at the way these plants were dying and it didn't look like a natural way of them dying. And all of a sudden it just felt wrong. Mm-hmm. It was that final thing of walking over that field again and again and again and again because I was going to my agroforestry and seeing this. And it was that final decision that, because before I think I probably would have done sort of a half-half on the farm, that some organic where I need to be for those markets and some conventional. And I've got to be organic across the board.
That's really interesting. I mean, I suppose I know you do. And if anyone who follows you on social media will have seen your video about where you talk about agroecology, and that's what you're doing on the farm.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things at the moment that seem to prompt a lot of discussion in farming, sort of the difference between you're laughing because you know about this agroecology or regenerative agriculture, or you know, people seem to get themselves into a bit of a state about these kind of things. You know, why is that, do you think? Why do people, are they just labels, are they you know, what is the difference, why do people get so worked up about it all?
I mean, so obviously they are just labels. My issue has been that, so regenerative agriculture and agroecology are exactly the same thing. So I define agroecology as kind of quite loosely. There's a great definition on the FAO, which is a 10-point definition. But my 3-point definition is that you're farming with nature, so nature kind of integrated into your system, that you are circular farming, so the idea of retaining your waste products and then utilizing those wastes as then secondary products on the farm. And then thirdly is the idea of food sovereignty. So the idea that my local community actually know how their food is grown, understand why their food is grown in that way, maybe have some part in growing it, that whole like proper link to ensure that your community values your food. Now, if you look back at the original definition of regenerative agriculture, it was exactly that, including the food sovereignty bit. But people don't realize this. And the reason that I define myself as agroecological is because, unfortunately, there's essentially been this move that people assume they are regenerative if they plant a cover crop and then no-till into it. And you're not even on the surface of what it is. And it's unfortunate because it's typical of this reductive nature of kind of how people think, and especially now. And it's so much more complicated. You have to look at an entire system change. And it's just that thing that, you know, so many people define themselves as regenerative farmers who are just zero till and farming with cover crops. And there are a lot of really, really good farmers out there. But I mean, you only have to look at the tea towel that you got from Groundswell from the cherries, which actually has the picture of the 5 tenets of regen. I mean, and that doesn't include the food sovereignty bit, which I'm fine with. If people don't want to get on board with the food sovereignty, I'm not bothered about that. The point of actually farming with integrated livestock, like in a way that minimizes your soil disturbance as much as possible, you know, make sure you're providing areas for nature to really kind of be its own thing. Like, yeah, that's the important thing. So if people got on board with the true meaning of regen, and I've been trying to kind of make friends with the word again in my own life, because most people know what regenerative, or think they know what regenerative farming is. But yeah, it's people always like to label themselves. I'm obviously an example of that if I'm calling myself agroecological. But it's just trying to, for me, it's trying to say, well, you know, this is what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And it say one word which just explains the sort of things that I'm doing on the farm.
Yeah. Okay. You mentioned areas for wildlife. One thing I do want to ask about is the wild seam that you've got planned across the farm. You're working with organizations on this. I think this is tremendously exciting. Tell us about that.
This is genuinely the coolest thing I've done. Like it completely smashes, like, so early adopter of no-till completely smashes that out of the park. Like, that goes a million miles away. Like, the agroforestry makes the agroforestry look like a little blip on the landscape. Although the agroforestry is kind of important to it. But essentially the idea of this is, how do I ensure that my entire farm is as interconnected as it possibly can be? Mm-hmm. We've essentially got, our farm is essentially 2 fields wide going along, if that makes sense. So we've got the ability to essentially carve this wild seam through the middle of the farm. The way that I'm going to do it is, so we don't want to plant it up. It essentially is going to be something a little bit akin to rewilding. I'm not a massive fan of that term particularly. But I've always been a little bit upset by the lack of plant diversity on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see, like, sort of 200-300 years ago, someone planted quite a lot of oak trees. And we've got a lot of kind of dog rose and stuff like that, which was probably planted, and hawthorn, obviously, and lots of brambles. But
yeah,
there's not much other different stuff. So my idea, and this is why I'm the Woodland Trust seem really excited by it, so I'm hopefully partnering with them, even if it's just from a sort of knowledge basis, even if they don't end up providing any funding, the knowledge base is going to be fantastic. To essentially on the western boundary of this, where we're, because we're fencing this wild scene as well, to plant a plethora of literally every single British fruiting bush and tree that you can think of. So sort of wild apples and wild plums and all these different things, with the idea being that if you provide the seed, birds are going to come in. And then what I'm trying to do on the farm, and this isn't just in the wild seam, it's in the margins of my fields that I'm leaving a lot wider, and I'm not mowing them either, I'm just letting them be there. Mm-hmm. It's trying to create areas where birds and animals can eat these and then poop them out all over the place and then have a chance to be able to grow. And so, I mean, where I've got this wild seam going at the moment, I've got it in the stewardship winter bird mix thing. And I've always had a problem with it. And I ended up using it because I thought I can sketch out where the wild seam goes. But I've always had an issue with it because you're not providing any habitat. You're just providing food. Mm-hmm. And then you have to do the other thing for another 300 quid to go and feed them over winter because then the food runs out. So you haven't created habitat. You've not really done anything. But with this wild seam, and by hopefully getting all these different fruiting plants on the farm, you are genuinely creating a habitat and a food source to actually, you know, rather than just a few small birds being able to have a home here, you've got the ability for a whole ecosystem to form and, you know, a place them genuinely to call home. This is where kind of locationally we're in a really good place, because obviously being in the southeast, from a lot of migratory points of view, a lot of birds should hopefully then see this and have the opportunity to kind of go onto it. And I'm also then, along with hopefully getting some knowledge and maybe some trees from the Woodland Trust, trying to partner with Essex Wildlife Trust. So at the moment we graze their marshes. But I'm trying to, because they're doing a big project on their marshes at the moment as well. So I'm essentially trying to ring fence my wild seam in with their marshes, so that this completely links together. And as it happens, their marshes go right onto the RSPB marshes.
Okay.
We've also got an area, which is kind of the start of my wild seam. It's kind of the inception of this idea, which is in between two seawalls, which are no longer tidal. So they've kind of wilded up over the last sort of 40 years or so. Mm-hmm. And that was my kind of inspiration for it. But I'm trying to, that's some land owned by the port. So it'll obviously feed into that as well. And it's going to end up being, if I'm lucky, it might be as large as sort of 250 to 300 acres.
Wow.
And we'll be able to kind of flop our yearling weaned cattle down there for a year. They can kind of go out there and be outwintered and just kind of roam about. It's just going to be absolutely mega. It's going to take ages to be anything. It's going to be one of those things I really proudly have done it. And it'll just look like absolutely nothing. Be a fence and some small trees. That'll be it. But the inception of the idea would be great.
Yeah. That is absolutely incredible, though. And I think what I find so cool about that is that not very long ago, if you'd have said you were doing that, people would have said, especially farmers, would have said, you must be absolutely insane. But, you know, you telling me about that, I find that tremendously exciting. And I think that's amazing. And a lot of other farmers, I think, will react like that as well, won't they? Have you had a genuinely sort of positive response?
I find it kind of goes two ways. This is partly why I don't like the word rewilding. I think if you say wilding, it's just a little bit less less abrasive for people. I think it really comes down to this this issue today. You hear people talking about the land sparing or the land sharing idea, don't you? And for me, like, the very kind of core of what agroecology is very much the idea of land sharing. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's the exact reason why this wild seam is so, so important. And also when it comes to kind of big developments that happen, there are obviously loads and loads of developments happening in on farmland.
Yes.
And of course, what normally happens is they then go and have some little postage stamp somewhere, a token bit of ecological offset, or whatever nonsense they call it.
Yeah.
And it's never linked to anything, and they are complete and utterly useless. Those postage stamps don't do anything. They do nothing for carbon. They do nothing for ecology. And it's why I think, you know, trying to show this example of A, how you can work with different organizations. I think that's a really, really important one, getting them on board, And it's not necessarily going to be easy, and there are going to be compromises and all this stuff, but that's great. Like, you get to a really good solution with that compromise. Mm-hmm. But trying to show that we need to link up all of these areas of nature to ensure that we can have some level of nature recovery. But I think that there's an awful lot of farmers don't necessarily subscribe to it. Mm-hmm. And I like to hope that by talking so enthusiastically about it, that people might be a little bit more excited. Because I know farmers do love nature. I don't know a farmer who doesn't love nature, mm-hmm. but there is a lot of thought that we should instead be kind of doing the land sparing thing and kind of farming with all the chemicals on this one bit of productive land and then leave lots of the rest. And I can understand that as an idea, but for me, I don't think it's the way forward, because you don't end up with, well, you can't do that organically. No. And for someone who firmly believes that an organic future is the way we should be going, then it doesn't work. We have to go down this sharing route and really interconnecting everything.
Yeah. So for the positive, I know you get a lot of positive reactions to the videos and things you make, because, you know, people who follow you on social media will have seen your videos, and you are hugely enthusiastic. I think that's why so many people love following you on that. And I know you get a lot of positive reactions, but you do get some negative reactions as well. You have had a bit of stick from certain elements in farming. Is that water off a duck's back, or does it bother you? Or,
well, I mean, psychologically, as I'm sure is always the case, that the negative always feels a lot weightier than the positive, doesn't it?
Yes.
I was talking to my local MP, Stephen Metcalf. I've got quite a good relationship with him, and he was around last year, and I was chatting to him and said, how do you deal with the crap that you receive? Because as a politician, you're going to get a lot of stick. And he said, you kind of get used to having to deal with it, but it always hurts. Mm. And I said, and he knows Boris Johnson really well. I said, well, how does Boris manage it? Yeah. I said, because Boris seems completely Teflon. Mm. And Stephen said, that's not at all the case. Apparently Boris has a really tight team around him that shields him from loads of the media.
Okay.
So he doesn't get to see it. And he is anything but Teflon, but it has to be the way he appears.
Yeah.
And it really, that really struck with me, because, you know, it shows how important it is to have that outward look. Mm. And I know a lot of people don't like Boris, so maybe that's a poor example, but it's an example of someone who appears completely unflappable.
Yeah.
For me, it really hurts, because I know that I'm doing things that are massively out of the box, but I think, I mean, farming would be a really boring sphere if it didn't have out of the box thinkers, and you're never going to push an industry forward without that.
No.
But consequently, like, people know I'm an outlier. So why is it necessary to give me a lot of shit for doing that? Like, it's, you know, essentially there are tons of incredible agroecological farmers in the UK, tons and tons and tons of them. And I'm very fortunate to know an awful lot of them. And I'm sure there are a ton I don't know because they're quiet. And it almost normally it goes with the idea of someone who farms in that way, that they're often quite quiet. They don't want to speak about what they're doing.
Mm.
And I sort of almost see my job as being the opposite of that, because I am outspoken. I am happy to be outspoken. And if people don't know about these different types of farming happening, no one's going to investigate it. So I have to be that outward facing. But the thing I find really hard is that if I'm not confident about the stuff I'm doing on my farm, who else is going to be?
Mm.
So obviously I'm super confident. Like, I don't know for sure if it's going to work. I've worked out a business model for my flour mill that should make pretty decent business sense, but until I'm 4 or 5 years down the line, I'm not going to be able to say that for sure.
No.
And you get all of this nonsense from people, and people saying you're doing far too many different things on the farm, and you should be concentrating on single things, which I don't think fits with an agroecological system, and is certainly a reason why I need more people on the farm. I just need to be able to afford it and keep it hard. But I mean, I massively suffer from anxiety. You know, it's regular that I wake up in the middle of the night, multiple times. I mean, I've always struggled with sleep anyway. And there are times like I'll just be kind of sick in my office and you have this weird little, your heart goes bananas from it. And you're just for some weird reason, you're just kind of cacking yourself and you don't know why. And it's almost my thing that I wish people on social media would understand the power of what they're saying.
Yeah.
And maybe I also probably sometimes fall into that trap as well. It's so difficult. It just shows how kind of poisonous it is. Mm. And it's the main reason why I do most of my work on Instagram, because Instagram is lovely and Twitter is this hellhole of vicious comments and it's just horrible.
Yeah.
And I almost think that one of the slightly funny things is that obviously we all fit into our silos on social media, don't we? My silo on social media originally was zero-till farming. So my silo is all these people who were following me. So the first 2,500 people who followed me because I was a conventional zero-till farmer.
Yeah.
And now those 2,500 people are the people who hate all the stuff I'm now saying about turning organic and introducing trees and introducing ponds in weird places and doing all that kind of stuff. So I almost think that they feel affronted by the fact, why is this person in my feed? He shouldn't be there. Let's get rid of him. But
it's funny, isn't it? I mean, I guess it was quite a surprise to me actually when you said you suffer from anxiety, because I mean, I do as well. And people never... You know, I know I've talked about it before, and people have always been surprised because they think, "Oh, you know, if you've got a podcast and you do that kind of thing, then you must be, you can't suffer." But I do, and it's always there, and it always will be. And I guess for you, you know, background in banking and always dealing with people, and musician, and on stage performing, you wouldn't necessarily think that. But I think it you know, it's really interesting that even someone who is as who has these ideas like you and is willing to put yourself out there, still sometimes, as you said, wake up in the night doubting yourself. And I guess we all do it to an extent. But as you said, I suppose that's the importance of why people say, you know, you should always, you never really know what's going on with people, so you should always be kind, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly that. And I think, I mean, I guess maybe you'd fit into this category as well of being an extroverted introvert.
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, you have the ability to kind of go out, and I can remember being a kid and kind of, you know, someone would ring the doorbell and it'd be one of parents' friends or whatever, and hiding in mum's skirt when I was sort of 3 years old or something like that, and having to force myself to learn to be able to put myself on show, essentially. I even remember at university someone being like, "How are you just so confident?" I was like, "Mate, if you knew." Not at all. Like, I'm just
I know. Well, when I sort of 4 years ago, whenever it was, 4.5 years ago, and I decided I was going to start this podcast and I was going to ring people up that I didn't know to interview them, my mum said, "What? How are you going to do that?" Because for years I was scared of talking on the phone. You know, my heart would be beating if I had to ring someone I didn't know. So, yeah, it does just show, doesn't it? But anyway, okay. The time's flying, so we'll wrap this up with the hard-hitting quick questions. What's your all-time favorite song?
This was almost a difficult one, and then I just had to go for this. This is a song that probably no one is going to know. It's a song called Ice Cream which has been played by loads of people, but it's specifically the Chris Barber's jazz band version of Ice Cream, and it's this really kind of silly Dixieland ditty of a song, which has the most banging clarinet solo in you can possibly imagine. I can sing it in my head now. I know exactly, and it's really hard. I've tried playing it. It is so difficult. And it starts off with this amazing bit of like speaking between a tenor sax and a trombone, like really silly stuff, and then kind of a bit of skiffle on the drums. It is the best tune ever, and it will just... I haven't found the Chris Barber's version, but I've occasionally used someone else's version on like Instagram stories because it brings so much joy to me. It's just silly and lighthearted and exceptionally musically talented. It's great.
Brilliant. I've just written that down. I'm going to check it out after. Okay. I know you're interested in food, obviously, as we've established. Well, what's the best meal you can make. So say the Queen is coming to visit the farm, and look at everything you're doing there, and you've said, rather than get caterers in, I'm going to cook lunch. What are you making?
Well, it's not going to be very refined. I'm more of a fan of, like, you know, something I can prepare in advance and then chuck in the oven. So I have always been a massive fan of making bolognese.
Okay.
And I have two key things about making the bolognese. One is, I one of the large Sacruzzo dishes, if it's not kind of spilling over the edge, I've done something wrong. It has to have a bottle of red wine in it.
Mm-hmm. A full bowl?
Yeah, not a glass. Not that nonsense. You've got to put a whole bottle in. So a whole bottle of wine.
Awesome.
And I like kind of doing a competition with myself as to how many vegetables I can put in the bolognese. I think my record was like 15. And it tasted stupendous. Bolognese, grated parsnip in bolognese and beetroot. Knocked it out of the park.
Big fan of beetroot. It's so underrated.
They have to be grated. And then also you have a bolognese which is dangerous to people's shirts, which is even better.
Presumably some homemade sourdough as well from the milk.
Yeah, I mean, I need to get my starter back up. I'm on like name 8 or 9 of sourdough starters because I'm really great at killing them. But
okay. What character from a movie or a book or a TV program do you relate to the most?
I mean, obviously, this is also going to be left field. This is from my...
I'd be disappointed if it wasn't, George.
This is from my joint favourite movie. So one of the early Peter Jackson movies, when he was making zombie films, and it's a film called Brain Dead. I think it was 92, I think. Amazing zombie movie. And it's this kind of quite quiet guy called Lionel, who obviously being a Kiwi as well, all Kiwis in this film, kind of quite a quiet guy called Lionel, who then ends up kind of being able to kill all the zombies. He uses a Flymo lawnmower to mow down all the zombies in one of the greatest scenes in cinematic history. Then at the end he gets the girl. I mean, I haven't got the girl yet, but I'm working on that bit. I aspire to get the girl, but you know.
hopefully not without having to kill zombies, but anyway, you never know with the way the world's going. Okay, I've got to ask you this. Which band or solo artist from any era would you most like to perform with on stage?
I was so close to going with Earth, Wind & Fire, which is, I mean, one of the greatest bands of all time. But I've ended up choosing Weather Report, who also one of the greatest bands of all time. Wayne Shorter, who growing up was my favourite sax player. They're the most killing band. Never get one of their live albums. They are weird.
Okay.
But if you get one of their studio albums, it's the most off-the-wall, fantastic music. I have a little sports car, like an MX-5, old MX-5, which like I only listen to music in. And it's either Earth, Wind & Fire or Weather Report that goes on in that car. And playing with those guys who are the most insane musicians would be the nuts.
Brilliant. That's very cool. Okay. Lastly, then, traditional way to end. What is your favorite agriculture related social media account to follow and why?
Well, again, someone who's also done this only a few weeks ago, but I've been following Ben Andrews for, I guess, like a year now, something like that. And I love Ben.
Yeah. Me too.
We've not met in person yet, but we've chatted on the phone.
Yeah.
And I he's someone like, such a varied farm. I love varied farms. And you learn so much about things. And he's just the loveliest guy. And that mustache. If I could grow facial hair,
I would
have a mustache.
I'm so jealous. I'm so jealous. One of the nice things about this podcast, when you speak to people, there's a few guests that you just sort of accidentally find out you have loads in common with, and throughout interviewing Ben, almost everything he said, I was like, oh yeah, me too. But disappointingly, the one thing was I can't grow a very good mustache.
I can't grow any beard. It only grows underneath my chin. I at 35 years old, I have the worst scenario, which is that if I don't shave, people look at me and go, what is going on? There's no designer stubble. It's just, oh, God, what's on your face?
So, yeah, well, mine's just old. Mine's just grey, makes me look old, so the kids give me lots of stuff. Anyway, George, thank you so much for your time today. I've been hoping that I could interview you in person, but it hasn't really happened over the last, because of the last 18 months, but hugely appreciated. Sure, we'll bump into each other somewhere, but thank you.
You're always welcome to the farm.
I will come down at some point. I'd love to see everything you're doing down there. And just thank you so much for enthusiasm with everything you do. I think it's so important for farming that we do. I mean, we talked about some of the sticky, but I think it's so important that we have people like you that sort of challenge conventional thinking. And I think it's quite easy to get dragged down with the way the world is a bit at the moment. And when you watch your videos, you're so enthusiastic. It's just a brilliant thing to see. Really does give me a lift, and I'm sure lots of other people too. So thanks for everything you do.
Well, thanks very much.
Sorry, I didn't mean to embarrass you. we're rubbish at that in Britain, aren't we? Accepting compliments. I always get mortified when anyone says nice to me as well. But anyway, okay. Great to speak to George, and hopefully catch you soon. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. I hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you, and good night.